This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
The young shining cuckoo is fed by its foster parents on insects and spiders. But the korimako, or bellbird, has a much more interesting diet of nectar. It's been something of a radio personality and has sung on shortwave radio to Australia and the Pacific nations for 30 years. However, the early recordings failed to reflect the versatility of the bellbird, with its wide variety of liquid notes and artistically placed clicks and bell-like sounds. It's not surprising that Maori mythology describes korimako, the bellbird, as the messenger of tane, sent to herald the coming of the sun.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good morning, friends. We're talking with Professor Stephen Zunis, a professor of international relations at the University of San Francisco, specializing in the Middle Eastern politics, U.S. foreign policy, and strategic nonviolent action. You can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz and then going to community, then going to podcast and then going to community or chaos. That's oar.org.nz, community or chaos at podcast. Stephen, how do you see the situation in Israel and Palestine, with ethnic cleansing and genocide still threatening the Palestinian people? What would Thomas Merton or Martin Luther King say about innocent bystanders? Is there such a thing?
I mean, we don't have to look at these great religious pacifist leaders to recognize that what Israel is doing is a horrific violation of international humanitarian law. Indiscriminate may be too general a word. I mean, it's clear they've actually targeted journalists and healthcare workers, rescue workers. And they have destroyed, not just by bombing, but by controlled demolitions, entire cities. And there's not a single university left. I mean, all the buildings essentially have been destroyed, not to mention schools and hospitals, mosques, libraries. I mean, you know, it is quite extraordinary, the level of the devastation. We're talking about 60,000. If you count the thousands of people that are still buried under the rubble because they don't have the heavy equipment to remove them. And also, of course, there have been tens of thousands who have died because they didn't have electricity for their respirators, or they couldn't see their oncologists for treatments for cancer or for any other diseases. Lancet, the prestigious medical journal, it talks of the death toll of possibly being over 100,000 at this point. And yet the international community has really refused to take action. Much of the fault, of course, is with the United States, which has abused its veto power, vetoing no less than 5 UN Security Council resolutions, otherwise unanimous Security Council resolutions seeking to end the war. 4 of those actually under the Biden administration. Indeed, the support for Israel in the United States is bipartisan. And one would expect Trump, perhaps, to have such a little disregard for international law. But we're finding that former President Biden, his vice president, the Democratic nominee last year, Kamala Harris, the Senate majority, or Senate Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer, the House leader, Hakeem Jeffries, all support unconditional military aid. In fact, additional military aid to Israel, even though polls show that only 15% of the population believe that we should be sending additional military aid to Israel in light of these war crimes. But even the European countries and New Zealand, Australia, other nations, have, while they've been, somewhat more willing to be critical of Israel and call for a ceasefire, have continued to have normal trade relations. And it scores, I think, quite frankly, the underlying racism that Palestinian victims are somewhat expendable. And of course, everybody knows Hamas is an extremist organization. They've engaged in heinous acts of terrorism. Very reactionary organization. But most Palestinians oppose them, and yet it's the civilians who are the ones who are being targeted. And now, of course, in addition to this continued killing, mass killings in Gaza, and they've gotten worse in recent weeks. I mean, there have been several incidents where Israelis have fired onto people lining up for food. And I should mention this, that this blockade of food and medical supplies, only allowing a tiny bit through this Israeli military-controlled distribution program, which is far less than people need and is actually designed to force people from the northern part of Gaza to the south in order to take it over. That is a major war crime in itself. You cannot deny a medical and relief and food and water to people. And Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, and Trump have been quite explicit about the end goal is. They want to totally depopulate the entire territory, over 2 million people, force them out, and basically rebuild the area as a Mediterranean resort.
Doesn't this
And
threaten our
both
essential?
Trump and Netanyahu have been explicit. That's what the goal is.
Doesn't this threaten our essential morality? Doesn't it threaten humanity in a sense?
Yeah, very much. I mean, there have been certainly other atrocities in the world. We think of the Congo, for example. We think of East Timor. We think of any number of situations in recent decades, some of which the West was culpable. And this is not the first genocide the U.S. has supported. In addition to East Timor, we think of Guatemala and the Hunter's War and the indigenous population in the early 80s. We think of Bangladesh in 1971. But this is more than these other cases. People are seeing what's going on there in real
Well,
time.
that's what I mean. We're seeing what's going on. And if we ignore it, it says something about us.
Yes, very much so. And of course, when the so-called advanced industrialized democratic world, is willing to allow that kind of thing to go on. Of course, this is what it gives extremist groups, terrorists, things like, if they, with all their power and might, aren't willing to play by the rules, why should we? And similarly, and getting a green light in Gaza, Israel ends up attacking Lebanon, again, killing many thousands of civilians. And then when the Syrian people finally overthrow the hated Assad regime, Israel ends up bombing that country extensively, and in addition to the southwestern corner, they already of Syria, the Golan Heights that they invaded and occupied in 1967, they extended that occupation even further, again with support from the United States. And now, of course, they've launched yet another war, this time on Iran, an unprovoked attack. Which is supposedly going after their nuclear program, which, but also, hitting media centers, energy centers, industrial capacities, government buildings that have nothing to do with their military or nuclear program. And once again, they're getting a green light from the Trump administration and congressional leaders of both parties in the United States.
I discussed this with a friend of mine, and they said that I was unbalanced.
Unbalanced?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think if Iran was bombing and invading its neighbors and killing tens of thousands of people, I assume you would be speaking out just as much. This is not one country versus the this is not a political thing. This is a humanitarian thing. I mean, obviously,
the idea of balance can sometimes
is terrible. Obviously, the Iranian regime is a oppressive, reactionary government. Despite their touted anti-imperialism, they've had their own imperialist agenda in the Middle East, supporting radical groups. I mean, I could, you know, I've worked, you know, closely with Iranian dissidents over the years, struggling for freedom in that country. But every one of them is shocked and horrified at what Israel's doing. They oppose it. This actually strengthens the regime by giving them an excuse to crack down even more. And of course, when a country is being bombed and attacked unfairly in a war of aggression, people are going to rally around the flag, no matter how much they might dislike the particular policies of the regime.
Well, where do we go from here? I mean, it seems to me that
let's look at the nuclear issue. In 2015, Iran signed an agreement with the United States, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China that was approved by the United Nations that allowed Iran to continue to enrich a small amount of uranium, as a couple dozen countries do as well, but with very, very strict safeguards that would make it physically impossible for them to develop fissile material the degree that could make an atomic bomb. And it came along with the most comprehensive inspection regime that's ever been established. But Trump broke it off. I mean, Iran had destroyed billions of dollars worth of equipment and fuel in return for lifting sanctions, but then Trump reimposed the sanctions. And it wasn't just U.S. sanctions. Trump made it clear that if any company or any government continued to deal with Iran, we would cut them off.
That's what they did with Cuba.
For example, Total, the French petroleum company, they continued to work with Iran. They couldn't sell their gas. They couldn't sell their petrol in the United States anymore. And so the Iranians obviously felt betrayed by this, and so they started reprocessing uranium, and it's gotten to a point where, while it's still, as far as everybody knows, a civilian program, they could branch off and go in a military direction in a fairly short period of time if they chose to do so. So if Israel and the United States are really concerned about Iran getting a nuclear bomb, the U.S. would have returned to the a nuclear deal, formerly known as the Joint Comprehensive of Action, which again was approved by the entire international community. But this really isn't about nuclear issues. This is not about protecting Israel from Iran getting a bomb. This is basically trying to kill as many Iranians as possible and weaken the regime that I think in fact is going to end up strengthening it. But also just kind of raises a question. Iran, and every Arab country, has called for the establishment of a nuclear weapons-free zone in the entire Middle East, similar to the nuclear weapons-free zone in the South Pacific, in Antarctica, in Southeast Asia, in Central Asia, in Africa, in Latin America. But the U.S. has strongly opposed, and this is under both Republican and Democratic administrations, a nuclear weapons-free zone because Israel would be forced to disarm their nuclear weapons, and the U.S. would no longer be allowed to bring its nuclear weapons into the region. I mean, your listeners remember how the U.S. bullied New Zealand and Palau and others, for their support of the nuclear weapons-free zone in the South Pacific. So this is really about hegemony. This is not about non-proliferation. Indeed, it raises the question, why if I certainly hope Iran doesn't develop an atomic bomb, but if they did, if Israel can do it, if Pakistan can do it, and India could do it, why not Iran? Well, people say, well, the UN Security Council has said that Iran can't do it, and they have to restrict their nuclear program, etc. But there are also, the United Nations also said, if you look it up, UN Security Council Resolution 487, Israel had to surrender its nuclear program to the International Atomic Energy Agency. And UN Security Council Resolution 1172 said India and Pakistan had to get rid of their nuclear weapons and their nuclear-capable missiles. And yet the United States has blocked the United Nations from enforcing these. We provide nuclear-capable jet fighters to all three countries. And we've even signed a nuclear cooperation agreement with India. So again, this is not about nuclear nonproliferation. This is counter-proliferation. This is nuclear apartheid. This is about hegemony. But if you try to impose this kind of regime of haves and have-nots, it just makes the have-nots want to try even harder. And let's say, let's look at the perspective of the Iranians for a moment. And again, I'm not certainly not an apologist for the regime, but Iranians are among the most nationalistic people in the world. Anybody who knows anyone of Persian ancestry knows how proud they are of their nation and their heritage, no matter how much they hate the Ayatollahs and the Revolutionary Guard and everything. But they're being treated like a banana republic. And Iran's been a regional power on and off for 2,500 years. But the U.S. position saying, no, you can't do this. But let's say again, look at the perspective of an Iranian. You were listed. The U.S. policy is regime change. The U.S. has invaded the country to your immediate east, Afghanistan, and the immediate west, Iraq in recent decades, overthrown their governments and occupied the countries, and then up in the long bloody war. And Iran has been listed alongside by the second Bush administration as part of the so-called Axis of Evil, along with Iraq and North Korea. Well, Iraq eliminated its nuclear program and brought nuclear IEA inspectors back in to verify it. And yet they were invaded anyway. North Korea, by contrast, threw out the IAEA and started developing nuclear weapons. They're still in power. Now, if you're an Iranian, what lesson do you get from that? You need a nuclear deterrent. And that's why, even putting aside the moral and legal questions, just how the U.S. Policy here is really counterproductive, and it's going to make it more likely, not less likely, that Iran's going to develop a nuclear weapon, especially since Israel does not have the capability to physically destroy their entire nuclear program, because they have a lot of these facilities are deep underground and fortified bunkers. And yes, they've killed some nuclear scientists, but there's a high level of education there. There are plenty of others who could take their place. And yeah, so this is really really bad news all around.
What kind of pressure is being put on Israel to soften their attitude toward Gaza and the Palestinians?
Well, what the United States has done in the past, occasionally, has been to threaten to withhold the billions of dollars of aid and other privileges. And the rare times the United States has done that, it's worked. Under Eisenhower forced Israel to withdraw from the Sinai from Gaza following the Suez Crisis in 1956. And Nixon forced them to stop their offensive in the later stages of the October 1973 war. Carter forced Israel to withdraw from most of the territory they seized in Lebanon, the 1978 invasion. Reagan forced them to stop their offensive and eventually withdraw from most territory in the 1982 invasion. The senior president Bush, forced at least temporarily them to freeze the additional settlements on the West Bank, though the Clinton and subsequent presidents allowed them to go ahead. And Obama stopped some of the previous Israeli offensives on Gaza, all by simply threatening to withhold aid. Biden categorically ruled that out, despite pressure from the State Department and you know, from at least 95% of Middle East scholars and others, you know, who are familiar with the region. Of course, Trump is even less concerned about
that's
international
what Biden will be Biden. Remembered for, isn't it, really?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think Biden. I mean, you know, we Biden was surprisingly progressive president on domestic policies.
But he'll be remembered for what Israel's done under his watch.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like Lyndon Johnson. I mean, he did great. I mean, the Great Society programs. I mean, in many ways, he was the most progressive president we ever had on a lot of domestic issues. But you know, most people remember him for Vietnam. And similarly, I think that Biden's legacy is going to be. Similar, you know. Similarly, he's going to be remembered for his culpability in this horrific war. There's a recent article in the New York Magazine just came out the last day or two from a Stacey Gilbert, who is a senior State Department official, said that that every person in the Biden administration who signed off on policies, decisions, and statement on Gaza completely forfeits any right to critique the Trump administration for lack of morals, lack of adherence to law, lack of respect for facts, because they laid the groundwork for it.
There's no chance of Trump doing anything, is there really?
I mean, one can always say that, you know, if there is a mass movement, it could have impact. I mean, it would eventually force Nixon to get us out of Vietnam, as much of a militarist he was. But we forced George W. Bush to.
But you had troops there.
Get troops out of Iraq, you know. So there can be.
America doesn't have any troops.
And we also forced Reagan to accept the Arias peace plan for Central America. So movements can make a difference, but unfortunately, I mean, the movement of what there is one, and we had, you know, over 5 million people go out on the streets this past weekend in protest against administration policies. But these are largely about the domestic policies. This is largely about saving our democracy against his authoritarian threats. But I think the one thing that could get his attention is if he really doesn't want American forces, American troops to get involved. He doesn't want to get in another endless Middle East war. And if let's say a scenario where Israel is starting to bomb areas in the center of Tehran, the civilian casualties are increasing. What if Iran feels desperate and they end up trying to block the Strait of Hormuz, where a good percentage of the world's oil, including a good percentage of New Zealand's oil, comes out of? And even if they couldn't completely close it, I mean, what insurer is going to insure a tanker in a war zone? So you can imagine the impact it's going to have not just on oil prices, but on the global economy as a whole. So, you know, I think there are a number, and if another thing is that, you know, continued U.S. support could lead some of these of Iran's proxy militia in Iraq to start attacking U.S. troops, and Trump would be in a position of either let's join in the fight. Or let's pressure Israel to stop. And the reason Trump became president in the first place, frankly, was in back in 2016 against Hillary Clinton, and in certain ways this is a factor in his election last year, was that he convinced a lot of white working class Americans whose children are the ones disproportionately sent to these overseas wars, that he wasn't going to do it, that the Democrats were the party of endless wars and foreign military intervention. And so, you know, this would end up, hurting a key component of his political base, which he'd be loath to do, I think.
What about other countries in Europe and also the BRIC countries? What kind of pressure can they put on Israel?
Well, China and Russia, don't have a very close relationship with Israel. They really can't have that. Can't really do much there. South Africa, of course, is, and Brazil, they're already, very critical of Israel and so strongly supportive of the Palestinians. The India is one of the few governments in the global south that is largely supportive of Israel, though frankly that is more about the Islamophobia of the Hindu nationalists than anything else. Europe is really the key. Next to the United States, I think Europe is really really critical here, and they have strong economic ties. The Europeans, of course, have supported Morocco's illegal occupation of Western Sahara because of their trade relationship with Morocco. Israel is even more important in that regard. But at the same time, you're having a huge backlash among the European civil society. I mean, in the Netherlands, just this past weekend, you had some like 300,000 or 400,000 people out in the streets in The Hague, protesting Israel's war. And the Dutch have actually been among the more pro-Israel of the European countries. So. It'll be interesting to see how Europe responds.
If the five nation permanent members of the Security Council didn't have an absolute veto, would this have made a difference?
Oh, it'd make a huge difference. I mean, every single one of these ceasefire resolutions, the United States was the only negative vote. This is like 14-1. Or one of them, I think, back when the Tories were still in power in Britain, they abstained, I think, in one of them. But otherwise, okay. The U.S. is very much an international outlier. Indeed, in the General Assembly, the U.S. has generally been one of maybe 10 or 12 to support Israel in its war. The others are these far right governments, like in Hungary and Argentina. Or these dependent South Pacific island states, very much dependent on U.S. Foreign aid. The very structure of the United Nations, makes it very difficult. Now, part of the problem in terms of Iran is that Iran is an international pariah in many ways for good reason, as of course is Hamas, but. At the same time, the extent of the Israeli war crimes and their violations of international legal norms are such that the United Nations would definitely take action. I think what's interesting to look at here is that in certain ways, the imperialism, if you will, of the United States and its disregard for international law, its attacks on the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. Again, these are bipartisan. Both parties have no respect for the international judicial institutions. Similarly, their attacks they're on the UN Human Rights Council. They're defunding the UN agency which provides aid to Palestinian refugees, not just in Gaza but in the West Bank, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon. I mean, the extreme anti-UN position, anti-international law positions, in many ways, it's the groundwork of the law breaking domestically that we're seeing by the.
Is the United States losing soft power, losing diplomatic respect, and willing and willing.
Whatever soft power we're using is also to support our allies, you know, whether they be.
But do our allies respect? Does America's allies respect America as much as they did five
not, years ago? Not anymore. Ago. Indeed, the Trump administration has largely eliminated the offices in the State Department and other agencies that projected soft power. The U.S. Agency for International Development. You know, like a lot of foreign aid programs in developed countries, some of their projects were a little questionable, but most of them did a lot of good, saved countless lives in AIDS prevention and hunger and vaccinations, things like that. Thousands of children have died, quite literally, as a result. Some say even tens of thousands.
How much
as a result of eliminating these
influence?
Not to mention offices of public diplomacy. Okay. They've eliminated the Voice of America. They've eliminated all sorts of soft power projections.
How much influence does the General Assembly potentially have on the structure of the United Nations?
I mean, they could conceivably do a kind of United for Peace resolution like they did for the Korean War or others. But, they've been passing all sorts of resolutions. But, again, it doesn't have any enforcement power. It's really the Security Council is what counts, and the U.S. has the veto power.
Could they?
It's not an accident, that the disregard for democracy internationally in terms of supporting occupation armies, supporting dictatorships, undermining the UN. And the fact that on a certain level, the American people, even the polls show they're actually sympathetic to international law, has not really been a priority. It's really, given the Trump administration, the belief that they can run roughshod over the U.S. Constitution, and domestic laws. I mean, again, I was very heartened to see 5 million people out on the streets just this past weekend. That's one of the largest demonstrations in U.S. history in terms of participation. It ranks up there. During the height of the Vietnam War and the original Earth Day and other mass protests, again, foreign policy was not. I mean, you had some Palestinian flags, you had some Ukrainian flags, but again, it was. I think that one part of the problem is that we are so desperate here trying to stave off authoritarianism. That those of us who have a particular interest in foreign policy and human rights, international law, I mean, unfortunately, we are kind of drowned out with all the other ongoing crises.
Non-radicals in New Zealand would like to see some kind of procedure where the five members could be overrun, that their veto wasn't absolute, that either a time factor or a 75% majority of the assembly could override the veto. We know that we're not likely to get rid of the veto, and we're not likely to displace those five members, but is there a possibility of the assembly changing the structure so the veto can, in certain circumstances, be overridden?
There have been all sorts of plans for UN reform. There's a whole industry there, and whole books have been written. And for any reform to take place, it has to pass the UN Security Council, and of course, the United States would veto it. And not just the United States. I mean, because if we did have a more fair Security Council, would France and Britain,
or even China
have their special status and not Japan or Brazil or India or other countries which whose populations, economy, and everything else are actually much bigger at this point.
Okay, what's your long range feeling about what's going to happen with Palestine and Israel in the intermediate or long-term future?
Yeah, I mean, it's the problem, of course, is that unless there's a change in U.S. policy, there's no incentive for Israel to change its policies. And the terrorist attack of October 2023, I think, in many ways hardened Israeli attitudes even more. And of course, even though Israel started the war, the fact that Iran is raining missiles down on Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities has hardened their militaristic proclivities even more. Another problem, of course, is demographic. Israel's getting is going to move more and more to the right, and part of it's simply because that the religious conservative hardcore nationalists tend to have big families, and the more secular leftist Israelis have small families, and that can create a shift. Not to mention all these secular leftists, a lot of secular leftists are have family members who are immigrating to Europe and elsewhere just because things have gotten so awful there. But I don't, unless, I really, there's got to be a shift in the policy of the United States and other Western countries. And I do believe that's forthcoming. I mean, if you look, for example, at polling data in the United States, younger voters are far more sympathetic to the Palestinians than older voters. I mean, even in fact, the gap is quite dramatic, even greater than LGBTQ issues, in fact. And so that's going to eventually reflect itself in American politics. And I think once the United States stops giving Israel a blank check, I think we're going to finally see some change, just as South Af apartheid South Africa, when the West finally imposed sanctions, the white South Africans realized they actually had to deal. But so the shift will come eventually. The question is how many people are going to die in the meantime.
Okay, let's. I'm going to have a break, and then we'll come back. That was William Butler Yeats' poem, prophesying in a way fascism. And we're talking with Stephen Zunis, professor of international relations, about the Middle East, also about what's happening in America. Let's hope that prophecy isn't completely true. Let's hope that prophecy isn't completely true. That was William Butler Yeats and the Second Coming. And you can podcast this by going to orradio.org.nz, then going to podcast and going to Community of Chaos. Well, Stephen, what's happening in the United States right now? And is
it's pretty scary. I mean, I remember us talking around the time of last year's presidential election, and about the very real risk of authoritarianism. And I was a little nervous saying that because I mean, I was concerned I might be overstating things somewhat, but we really are. Seeing all the dangerous signs, the attacks on academia, for example, where the Trump has unilaterally cut off research funding for major universities that are unwilling to eliminate efforts at diversity, inclusion, equity, accessibility, that kind of thing, or are unwilling to suppress pro-Palestinian demonstrators. He's actually banned foreign students, which are a major lifeblood of American universities because most of them pay a full tuition. He has is eliminating funding for National Public Radio and the public broadcasting a service. He and he basically he's and he's forced law firms to do a pro bono work for him, otherwise cutting them off from government contracts. A number of universities have banned speakers and entertainers, and even fired professors for expressing pro-Palestinian views for fear of even more retribution. They've even been a limit. He's dispatched Marines and other army forces into cities where they are having mostly peaceful demonstrations against the will of the governors and the mayors. The big thing, of course, is the raids on against immigrants, some of which are undocumented but are vital for the agricultural, construction, and restaurant industries. But they seem to also be rounding up U.S. citizens who happen to be brown and or speak with Spanish accents or otherwise suspect might be undocumented immigrants. And he's even, without due process, deported them to these horrific prisons in El Salvador, including people who are here legally. He's basically eliminated any kind of asylum claims, and it's actually banned any kind of travel from over a dozen nations. I could go down the list. He's also politicizing the civil service, basically, pledging people, removing civil service protections, and basically insisting that government workers do their support his ideological agenda. One of the bizarre things happened this weekend was that he insisted on having a North Korean style military parade on his birthday. And it cost millions of dollars, basically shut down Washington, D.C., so you could have all these troops and tanks and everything, parade in front of a reviewing stand in the White House. Again, the kind of thing you would expect to see in Pyongyang
It's the
or
kind of thing you
Moscow.
have see often in Russia,
Oh, yeah,
particularly.
exactly. And yeah, and the what is so we really are, and of course, usually, I mean, theory, the United States has this system of checks and balances that the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary are independent bodies that can put checks and balances on each other. But the Congress is controlled by Republicans that are largely supporting his agenda. So they're pretty much letting him get away with these things and even codifying some of these. I mean, he's even taking over a lot of congressional things. For example, he fired the Librarian of Congress because and replaced replaced her with again a loyalist. And the judiciary is largely consists of a very conservative judges who support strong executive powers that were appointed by him. And by a former president, George W. Bush. So we don't have the judiciary. The judiciary blocked some of his decrees, but is allowing a lot of them to stand. So we really are seeing a situation comparable to Hungary under Orban, or for or similarly with like Modi in India, where the president has taken on extraordinary powers, and is and I mean and again it's just the other examples of abuse is that the Secretary of Homeland Security came into Los Angeles and said the federal government is liberating this from these from the socialists who are running the city. Essentially a threatening for federal takeover of the local government.
Homeland
And
Security.
Alex Padilla, who is the U.S. Senator from California, was there. This is a press conference to ask a question, and these federal agents grabbed him and dragged him out of the room and threw him down and handcuffed him. This is a U.S. senator. So we're th I mean, again, this is unprecedented.
These
It's
this.
never seen.
What's the name of the forces that are that cover Border Patrol and so on? What's
Yeah, there's the
is this Homeland Security?
yeah, well, the immigration thing is called U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE for
Isn't
short.
ICE almost become a kind of army for?
Yeah, I mean they're masked, they're in plain clothes, and they basically are kidnapping people. I mean,
Yeah,
they've
I've seen
literally
them.
grabbed
I've seen
people.
pictures of them, and they've got these full face masks, and they're grabbing people.
And heavy equipment. They literally, grab people off the street and throw them in the back of unmarked vans. I
Does
mean, they
that
really
remind you
are.
of anything that's happened in
Well,
foreign countries?
very much so. And they have detained people, without adequate, food, water, or medical care in these crowded cells, and then ship them on these, flights, to friendly authoritarian governments, where they're kind of disappeared. And again, I don't believe in actually talking about this in terms of the United States, but this is exactly the kind of thing we're seeing now. Now, again, the good news, and again, I referred to this earlier, is that we did have 5 million people out in the streets. I'm sorry, 7 million people out in the streets. Which is a is close to 3% of the entire population, which is quite large for a country that is spread out and diverse as the United States.
What was the theme of the demonstrations?
Basically it was no kings. That it was hearkening back to the American Revolution of the 1770s, where we formed one of the world's first republics, in opposition to this kind of one man rule. And so it was very interesting. It was I mean, there are a lot of American flags and a lot of patriotic symbolism. That the left and moderate voices in the United States are trying to reclaim a patriotism, which the right has usurped for its agenda. One thing that's concerning is that the Democratic Party, which is not a left party, it's a centrist party. In fact, in foreign policy, it leans right, as I alluded to earlier, but it. Their politicians have been, the leadership at least, have been
They're very
super
mute,
cautious.
haven't they?
They've been super cautious, and that's gotten a lot of people really frustrated. Some of the younger, more left-leaning members have been more active, but in my study of anti-authoritarian movements around the world, a key variable for success is when the more grassroots, more radical elements, and the more mainstream opposition leaders can work together. But the Democrats are really scared of their base. They don't like the grassroots activists, and of course, the grassroots activists are pretty disappointed and frustrated at the Democratic Party leadership. So that's going to take some time. Another concern, though, and this also happened this weekend, was that a right-wing activist, a big Trump supporter, ended up shooting two state legislators in Minnesota, and their spouses. One couple was killed, There is a state representative Hortman, who's actually had been the speaker of the Minnesota State House, very influential and skilled progressive politician. You know, she was murdered, assassinated. And when you have this kind of rhetoric where the president of the United States calls opponents enemies of the people and disloyal and that they hate America, and you have unstable people who have very easy access to guns, which of course is what you can do here in the United States, you know, really, there have been several attacks now, and, you know, concern about other political assassinations of anti-Trump politicians.
What do you think will happen in the congressional elections? I understand that Alexandria Cortez is now 35 years old, and that both she and Bernie Sanders have been fairly popular at these rallies and so on. Do you think we may get new Senate and congressional leadership?
I mean, I think there's definitely a push, you know, for a more progressive alternative. But, you know, it was the fear that of the more left-leaning, social democratic-leaning wing of the Democratic Party that led the party bosses to push, you know, people like Hillary Clinton, like Joe Biden, you know, like Kamala Harris. And even though polls show that the more left-leaning politicians would have actually defeated the Republicans, because, you know, the way to fight right-wing populism is left-wing populism. If you have the kind of this neoliberal centrist as the alternative, you know, people, there are a lot of working-class people that would have otherwise voted to the left and end up voting for the far right. So I really think we're going to have a big battle, both in the congressional elections next year and the presidential elections in 2028, not just between Democratic and Republicans, but within the Democratic Party, among the more progressive, more activist people, more willing to openly challenge the administration, and the more cautious institutional focused incumbents.
You think the opposition to Trump will continue?
Oh, it's only going to grow. It's only going to grow. Okay. Because a lot of his policies, even putting aside the moral and legal questions, aren't working. His tariffs and everything else have made a mess economically, and you know, people are finding out that the unemployment's going up, and it's causing all sorts of problems. Eliminating these government jobs is not just eliminating these particular jobs, but, for example, the national parks are not getting as many visitors anymore, and that's hurting the local economies. And again, there are all sorts of ways where it's really hurting ordinary people. So I can only see the opposition growing.
Okay, thanks a lot. That's a good place to stop, and a hopeful place to stop our program. Thanks a lot for coming on, and take care of yourself, Stephen.
Thank you, Marvin. Great to talk to you again.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.